Despite evolving attitudes, we should avoid too much optimism about the expanding moral circle. We are not far removed from previous generations who, could they see where we are now, might resist what we think of as progress and worry that the moral circle has narrowed in important ways. For example, a decreased concern for the preferences of our ancestors, the moral demands of religious deities, or even the natural environment relative to some past cultures. Also, while we usually think of the moral circle as our attitudes, if we instead define it as our behavior, then the advent of factory farming suggests significant backward moral progress. These reasons for pessimism might not be enough to think overall that we have a narrowing moral circle, but they remind us that backsliding is possible, or more likely a stagnation, where the circle doesn't fully expand to reach all sentient beings. We need hard-working do-gooders to keep pushing forward. It has become increasingly challenging to maintain the contradiction between our treatment of animals and this moral progress. We subject rats to psychological experimentation to better understand the neurological basis of emotions, trying to convince ourselves that the experiments are ethical because the rats have no emotions. We test painkillers on animals, justifying this by telling ourselves that they don't suffer the way we do. We imagine that dogs lack our own sophisticated awareness of the world, but we still use them for guidance when we lose our own vision. I will discuss the future of moral circle expansion and associated risks at greater length in the final chapter of this book. But today, it remains true that there is great momentum for the expansion of the moral circle to the animal populations. And as I will show in the coming chapters, the moral arc is swiftly closing in on the institution of animal farming. 2. Emptying the cages. U.S. factory farms, where an estimated 99% of farmed animals are kept, are almost as inaccessible to the public as they are inescapable for the animals locked inside. When I started getting more involved in discussions about animal farming, I knew I had to see the inside of one of these facilities for myself. I finally got my opportunity with a rescue team from a California farmed animal sanctuary. The sanctuary was able to convince a handful of farmers to allow them to rescue some of the chickens in their spent flocks. The industry term spent is used to describe hens whose reproductive systems are too worn out to be profitable, at which time the animals are killed. These hens were bred to lay eggs, not produce meat, so they can't be sent to the slaughterhouse. Farmers would have to spend money killing the hens and disposing of their bodies. Relinquishing them to the rescuers spares the farmers that cost. The rescue took place at a battery cage farm in the Central Valley of California in early 2016. Battery cages are thin wire enclosures that are typically so small the hens can't even spread their wings. They're named for the way identical units are stacked end-to-end, like electrical batteries. In 2008, California residents passed Proposition 2, a ballot measure in California that added this section to the California Health and Safety Code. In addition to other applicable provisions of law, a person shall not tether or confine any covered animal on a farm for all or the majority of any day in a manner that prevents such animal from A. lying down, standing up, and fully extending his or her limbs, and B. turning around freely. Over 8 million California residents turned out in favor of Proposition 2, the highest positive turnout for a citizen initiative in the state's history. Many thought this would end the cruel confinement of egg-laying hens in the state. But despite the overwhelming public support for the bill, reform can be slow, and these dreadful cages are still common. In order to comply with the new law, the farm I visited had simply taken out the walls separating the batteries. This means that each hen has more total space in her cell, but she has more cellmates. Recent investigations have shown that some California farms haven't even made these changes, and there has been only one recorded enforcement of the law in the entire state, which was home to an estimated 12 million egg-laying hens in 2017. We entered the farm before sunrise so the sleepy birds would be less anxious and easier to handle. We drove through a large metal gate with signs warning keep out and biohazard, and past a dozen sheds with metal roofs and walls of plastic netting. The stench of ammonia was burning our mouths and throats, even outside the barns. We unloaded our transport crates, donned our disposable coveralls, sanitized our boots, and entered the designated shed. From the entrance, we looked down a dozen rows of cages, each approximately 150 feet long. Cages were stacked on each other in two levels, one just above and one just below eye level. On the floor below them was a 6-inch-tall, foot-wide mound of feces, which at first looked hard enough to stand on, but the new volunteers got ample warning from veterans that the dry exterior hid a moist, rotting interior. The birds were already agitated from hunger when we came in. The farm didn't waste any money on feeding them before we arrived. But the lights and our presence stressed them out further. In the absence of rescue, the spent hens face a cruel fate. In normal circumstances, a farmhand pulls a large wheeled box down each row, grabbing the chickens by whatever body part is accessible and ripping them out through the tiny doors of their cages, breaking limbs and tearing skin in the process. The hens are then thrown into the dark, cramped chamber until it's full, and the little air that is left in the box is replaced with carbon dioxide. Injured, confused, and terrified, the chickens die slowly from asphyxiation in a cage of flesh. Hens used for eggs are typically killed at between a year and a half and 2 years old, a small fraction of the potential lifespan of the chicken's most recent ancestor, red jungle fowl. Fortunately, we were there to help. But of the thousands of birds slated to be killed and discarded on this one farm that day, we could save only a few. We worked in teams to safely transfer the hens from the cages to our transport crates. Some of us reached into the cages to pull out the birds, bruising our arms on the edges of the narrow doors as we carefully pulled out one bird at a time, holding her wings against her body so she didn't flap them and break one on the way out, while other rescuers opened and closed the transport crates. The hens tried desperately to escape our reach, crowding into the corners of the cages and dodging our hands. Some bit us, others cried out in fear when rescuers picked them up, and many were breathing heavily and with open mouths, an indicator of stress. Many birds had wounds from fighting and climbing over each other in the cramped cages, and injuries from incessant contact with the metal cage. Some were missing eyes and had infected cuts from broken wire. In each cage, you could tell who the dominant birds were and who had been picked on. All the birds were thin, but those who had been bullied were severely emaciated. They were missing many feathers, which other birds had pecked off in agitation. Anxiety had driven some birds to peck off their own feathers. There were many dead birds, too, some whose legs and heads hung limp and were beginning to decompose after they had become hopelessly trapped between the wires of their cage walls. Each rescuer managed the experience differently. Some people's hands shook while they consoled the hens, promising them that they would soon be free of this hellhole. Some quietly let tears roll down their faces while they worked on the task at hand with solemn tenderness. Others were angry and snapped at fellow rescuers for any misstep. My focus was on diligence and observation. I hoped to absorb as much as I could from the experience, in particular the perspectives of the hens themselves, because I knew my attention to detail could help me better communicate my experience in the future. I needed to remember these stories, not just of the hens who made it out alive to live happily at the sanctuary, but also those who remained on that farm, dead or alive. This harrowing experience helped me put a face, actually more than 7,000 faces in the shed we visited, on the horrors of animal farming. How did we get here? The industrial system we now recognize as factory farming emerged in the early 20th century when rural farmers struggled to supply enough food for an increasingly urbanized population. In the U.S., high prices and food shortages led to a nationwide meat boycott in 1910. The start of World War I in 1914 increased the strain on small farms as the U.S. government struggled to feed its troops. Trying to feed a 20th century country via a 19th century food system led to protests and riots, such that growing the food supply became a national priority. Farmers and bureaucrats quickly began looking for ways to increase the size and efficiency of the animal agriculture industry. The first factory farm was probably Mrs. Wilmer Steele's broiler house in Delaware. Cecil Steele was one of the first farmers to breed chickens specifically for their meat production, starting the genetic division of labor, whereby some chickens now lay eggs with rapid frequency, while others grow such large breasts they often collapse under their own weight. In 1923, Steele's first flock had 500 chickens, but due to enormous demand, efficient breeding, and optimized living conditions, she was raising 10,000 per flock by 1926. Over the next century, to supply the relentless demand for efficiency, large-scale and vertically integrated producers dominated the industry. In 1940, 17% of the U.S. population worked in agriculture, compared to 1.5% in 2016. Scientific developments, like the use of antibiotics in animal feed, allowed producers to confine animals in smaller and smaller spaces without a prohibitive increase in disease transmission. This industrial transformation led to much of the animal suffering we have alluded to so far. Animal farming uses sentient beings as machinery to produce dairy or eggs, and as raw materials to produce meat. The industry publication Hog Farm Management told its readers in 1973, "Forget the pig is an animal. Treat him just like a machine in a factory." An embedded industry. Farm policy is heavily weighted in favor of animal farming, especially factory farming. As animal advocate Paul Shapiro put it in a National Review opinion piece, factory farms get bailouts when they overproduce, have their most costly business expense, feed, subsidized, get federally supervised dollars to market their products, and even get free research and development that they benefit from, but for which they don't pay a cent. In what Quartz called the U.S. meat industry's wildly successful 40-year crusade to keep its hold on the American diet, these companies have heavily influenced even the U.S. dietary guidelines. In 2015, the Scientific Advisory Committee for the Guidelines suggested a shift toward plant-based diets in the interests of public health and sustainability, but the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the USDA, which experts agree is heavily influenced by the industry, decided not to use those recommendations and ultimately left out any discussion of reducing meat, dairy, or egg consumption in the published guidelines. This influence on policy began as soon as U.S. industrial farming emerged. For 30 years after industrial pasteurization equipment became available in 1895, public health advocates pressured local governments to require its use for milk production. Some governments were hesitant to make the changes, but large producers pushed hard for such regulations because smaller milk companies competing with them lacked the funds to quickly purchase and maintain the expensive equipment. This corporate influence is comparable to that of the gun lobby. While 94% of Americans support requiring background checks for all gun buyers, and 86% support a ban on gun purchases from anyone on the U.S. terrorist watch list, attempts to implement such uncontroversial policies have failed. Experts speculate that the gun industry's power is owed largely to the preemptive measures that were taken to prevent gun regulation in the early 2000s, after the industry saw the damage that aggressive regulation had done to the tobacco industry. The difference in outcomes between the movements against the gun and tobacco industries is an important case study for impact-focused activists. These preemptive measures are similar to anti-regulatory laws currently being lobbied for by the animal agriculture industry, deviously called right-to-farm laws. The laws vary in their exact wording, but the recent ones try to curtail future regulation with broad generic protections. Missouri, for example, actually added one to its constitution in 2014 with a narrow 50.1% majority vote. Critics, including small-scale farmers as well as environmental and animal activists, argue that these sweeping laws could curtail important beneficial regulations, such as preventing factory farms from polluting local groundwater. This coalition is trying to shift the discussion around these laws from the protection of factory farmers, implied by the term right to farm, to the harmful consequences by calling them right to harm laws. At this point, right to farm is still more common. Language is a powerful tool, but activists have no monopoly on loading public debate in their favor. For another example, try filling in the blanks below. Beef, it's blank. The incredible, edible, blank. Pork, the other, blank. And of course, got blank? If you remember those slogans from your childhood and answered, what's for dinner, egg, white meat, and milk, that's because multi-million-dollar government-supervised advertising campaigns worked to drill them into your memory. These campaigns are run by research and promotion organizations funded by companies in their respective industry, such as the American Egg Board, AEB. The theory behind these checkoff programs is that certain products are largely homogeneous, meaning it's hard to tell 1 gallon of milk or cut of beef, case of mushrooms, jar of honey, from another. Since this makes it challenging for individual companies to differentiate and advertise their specific products, the industries partnered with the U.S. government to establish requirements for companies to fund organizations that advertise on behalf of all relevant companies. For example, egg producers with more than 75,000 hens are currently required to check off 10 cents per case of 30 dozen eggs to the AEB. Government support of these programs, requiring by law that producers participate even when it's not in their self-interest, gives the industries, most of which are in animal agriculture, significant power in the American marketplace. In the next chapter, I'll discuss how these organizations often overstep their bounds with illegitimate activities, further increasing the power their industries hold over the American dinner plate. The biggest impact so far. In the fall of 2016, dozens of animal advocates descended on Massachusetts from across the country, joining hundreds of in-state activists to participate in the Yes on 3 campaign for the November ballot. I was able to join for the last few days leading up to the vote on the referendum. We went door to door discussing the measure, which sought to prohibit the most extreme farmed animal confinement, similar to Prop 2 in California. Most of the conversations were short. The residents just told us they had already voted or were definitely going to vote in favor. In fact, the measure ultimately received an overwhelming 77.7% of the vote. Interestingly, almost everyone I spoke to about the initiative brought up how upset and concerned they were by footage they had seen from undercover investigations of animal farms. This is a common experience for advocates of both plant-based eating and farmed animal welfare, in every situation from handing out pro-vegetarian leaflets to talking with journalists. Almost everyone who cares about the issue does so because of videotaped investigations of animal farms. And the most dedicated, passionate people in the movement are even more likely to be driven by their knowledge of the suffering farmed animals endure, which they learned about through investigations, than other information, such as environmental and health concerns. If I had to choose one strategy that has built the most momentum for the movement, it would be the undercover investigations that have exposed and publicized the implications of the modern machine in a factory approach to farming animals. Undercover investigations of animal farms essentially began in the early 1990s, following investigations of animal testing laboratories in the 1980s. Of course, there were earlier exposés, such as Upton Sinclair's work leading to the publication of his novel, The Jungle, in the early 1900s. It seems the first investigation of the modern era was conducted by the pioneering animal rights organization People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, PETA, in 1983 at a Texas horse exporter, shortly after PETA's famous lab animal investigation in Silver Spring, Maryland in 1981. More food industry investigations followed in 1991 when PETA investigated a cow slaughterhouse, a pig slaughterhouse, and a chicken hatchery. The first modern animal farm investigation, in 1992, exposed the cruelty at Commonwealth Enterprises, a New York farm producing foie gras, the fattened liver of a duck or goose. The major finding was that, contrary to prior claims by the company, the ducks were force-fed. Three times a day, each worker would shove a long metal pipe down the throats of around 500 birds. The pipes caused the birds serious pain and resulted in subsequent health issues, such as damaged esophagi and pneumonia. This research led to the first U.S. police raid of an animal farm, though reports by activists suggest the foie gras industry successfully pressured the district attorney into dropping the charges. Federal law at that time and today excludes farmed animals from standard animal cruelty protections. These investigations started receiving major media attention in the late 1990s. A 1998 PETA investigation of a pig breeding farm led to the first felony indictments ever for cruelty to farmed animals. It revealed shocking, systematic cruelty from daily beatings of pregnant sows with a wrench and an iron pole to skinning pigs alive and sawing off a conscious animal's legs. PETA's McCruelty campaign against McDonald's in 1999 and 2000 led to one of the first major corporate commitments to reducing farmed animal suffering, though PETA has since restarted its campaign after McDonald's failed to take continued steps to increase welfare. While PETA made huge strides for the animal rights movement, impact-focused animal advocates worry that PETA has also done substantial harm to the movement, with off-putting campaigns that feature naked women, oversimplify similarities between animal cruelty and historical atrocities such as slavery and the Holocaust, shame overweight Americans, feature goofy animal costumes, and otherwise lead to the public perception that animal protection is a less serious, less important, and anti-intersectional social movement. From PETA's perspective, these gimmicky tactics lead to so much more coverage and exposure for the group and its messages, outweighing the negative reactions. Other advocates disagree. They often struggle to be taken seriously when associations with PETA arise, and they feel the need to bend over backward to convince their audience that they really aren't from that animal rights group. Not only has PETA's hunger for attention ostracized animal protection from other social movements and trivialized animal issues in the eyes of the public and the media, but the organization has attacked the use of research and evidence among animal advocates, presumably because this trend has shifted resources toward other animal nonprofits, especially those working on farmed animal issues. In fact, I would argue that the veracity of PETA and similar nonprofits, their pursuit of attention above all else, has been one of the two biggest mistakes of the farmed animal movement to date. At the end of this chapter, we'll discuss the second issue, which I think is far more ubiquitous and similarly harmful. I do want to be clear that I think these are all only strategic mistakes, and that the vast majority of animal advocates, including the leadership of PETA, truly have the best interests of the animals in mind. Another early landmark for the movement, when animal advocates were just beginning to focus on farmed animals, was a 2001 egg farm investigation by Compassion Over Killing, COK. The investigation received national media attention, leading to an interesting quote by the egg producer in the Washington Post. "We use normal industry practices. The investigator's complaint lies with our industry, not our facility." These days, after over a decade of experience with investigations, industry professionals instead respond to almost every new investigation by condemning the individual facility as a bad apple. Around this time, a teenager from Ohio founded Mercy for Animals, MFA, which would become quite possibly the most impactful farmed animal organization of the decade. In 1999, when Nathan Runkel was 15, a local high school teacher brought a bucket of dead piglets from his farm to class for dissection. One piglet was still alive, so a student who had worked on the teacher's farm implemented the standard practice of thumping, holding on to the piglet's hind legs and swinging her head into the ground to kill her. The piglet survived that violence, despite having a broken skull, and the other students were outraged and attempted to save her. They regrettably failed, but the incident attracted local media attention and inspired Runkel to create MFA later that year. Since the organization's founding, MFA has relentlessly pursued effectiveness, placing the desire to maximize its impact above all else. MFA's main activity has been conducting and publicizing investigations, such as through pro-vegetarian leafleting and student outreach on college campuses. Its tactical, calculated campaigning has sown a substantial discomfort with factory farming in the U.S. public consciousness. MFA's coverage in almost every leading U.S. media outlet and many leading publications in other countries seems to have steered the global conversation on animal farming. MFA deliberately limits the number of North America investigations it releases to prevent media oversaturation, exhausting the topic of animal cruelty in the eyes of journalists and readers. Instead of more North American investigations, MFA has prioritized investigations in countries where few or none have been done in the past. The organization is also involved in corporate campaigning for more animal-friendly business practices, which we will come back to later in this chapter. The other leading organization for farmed animals in the 2000s was the Humane Society of the United States, also due in large part to its commitment to effectiveness. HSUS had for decades been a leader in the protection of pets, wild animals, and other populations, but the organization did little work for farmed animals prior to the early 2000s. Fortunately, the current leadership's focus on impact led them to adjust their strategy to account for the fact that over 99% of all domestic animals are those raised for food, and that these animals endure some of the greatest suffering. After their current CEO, Wayne Pacelli, stepped into his role in 2004, HSUS quickly hired Paul Shapiro, the founder of COK, to establish a farm animal protection department. In 2008, HSUS released a groundbreaking undercover investigation of a California slaughterhouse. It showed, among other cruelties, the use of forklifts to force downer cows, cows so sick or injured they cannot stand or walk, to march to slaughter. Exposure of this practice, which suggested a threat to food safety, especially given the slaughterhouse's involvement with the U.S. school lunch program, led to the largest beef recall in U.S. history. The same year, HSUS led the campaign to pass Prop 2 in California. I should note here that MFA, HSUS, and many of the nonprofits, companies, and individuals we'll discuss in this book are part of effective altruism, the burgeoning social movement and philosophical mindset on which my research and this book is based. It's been a delicate struggle for animal protection groups to ensure the media coverage of undercover investigations reflects the important, everyday problems they expose. Journalists and animal agriculture representatives often want to focus on the most explicit, egregious cruelty, like workers punching and kicking animals. This abuse is more headline-grabbing, but is unfortunately easier for the industry to write off as the practices of an errant few. In response, animal protection groups now focus on exposing the rampant cruelty across the industry. MFA says it randomly selects farms to investigate, and other groups have specifically sought out farms with leading humane certifications in order to show that even the animals on those farms, whom many consumers think are happy, still suffer tremendously. Animal Ag's Big Blunder. Since undercover investigations began, one of the biggest contributors to their success came, inadvertently, from animal agriculture lobbyists. the meat, dairy, and egg industries tried to stop investigations by passing laws in state legislatures to limit the ability to document animal farm operations. The first such law, passed in Iowa in 2011, prohibits undercover audio or visual recording of an animal facility and possessing or distributing any such record. In essence, animal ag is sought to punish those who expose abuse rather than those who commit it. The public backlash to these ag-gag laws, as they are now widely known, began as soon as they were discussed in the mainstream media. Food columnist Mark Bittman popularized the term in a New York Times article shortly after the Iowa law was passed. He referenced a Texas investigation from earlier that year, which showed calves being hammered to death by workers, animals confined in tiny crates with barely enough room to turn around, pervasive health issues, and the standard industry practice of dehorning calves by burning the budding horns out of their skulls with hot metal cutters. These laws have been passed in numerous U.S. states, though many have failed, and the Idaho and Utah ag-gag laws were struck down in the courts as unconstitutional. Numerous journalists and public figures have denounced the laws, and that coverage has led many to speak out against eating meat and against the animal agriculture industry as a whole. A psychological experiment even corroborated this effect, suggesting that simply learning about the laws led to decreased trust in farmers and increased support for animal welfare regulation. One of the leaders in this fight is Will Potter, a thoughtful and soft-spoken investigative journalist and author of Green is the New Red, a book about the government and industry repression of environmental and animal rights activists, including the use of the provocative label eco-terrorist to disparage peaceful activists. In April 2013, Potter debated Emily Meredith, director of communications for the Animal Agriculture Alliance, on Democracy Now!, an independent progressive news program. Potter pointed out that the ag-gag laws are opposed by many groups outside of animal protection, such as the American Civil Liberties Union and National Press Photographers Association. The reasoning of these groups is straightforward. We wouldn't accept laws silencing whistleblowers in any other commercial workplace, senior living facilities, daycare centers, textile factories. So why give animal farms and slaughterhouses special treatment? The best argument Meredith could muster was that the videos caused damage to farmers and their reputations because they were harsh criticism. She felt the investigators were incriminating farmers by releasing the videos directly to the media without giving them an opportunity to defend themselves or take corrective action, to which Potter responded by noting that advocates consistently reported the findings of their investigations to authorities, resulting in numerous felony charges. A frequent rebuttal from Meredith and other industry representatives is that animals would be better served if witnesses reported incidents of cruelty immediately, so the animals could be helped as soon as possible. While this might sound like a tenable position, animal cruelty allegations simply aren't taken seriously unless there is a lengthy record of abuse, and given the lack of any meaningful welfare laws for animals on farms, documenting abuse is necessary to expose conditions on animal farms and generate public pressure to see justice done for the animals. In June 2013, after this debate and another on CNN, where even the moderator appeared to take the side of animal advocates, Meredith appeared on The Daily Show. Among other provocative, humorous questions, she was asked, "So let me get this straight. You're protecting the animals from the people that are trying to protect the animals." She answered with a clear yes, perhaps not fully understanding the loaded question. Later in the interview, Meredith raised a concern about the activists using their videos for fundraising, and the interviewer asks, "So it's the activists that are connected to the bottom line, not the farmers?" Meredith responds, "Yes, the animal activist industry is a huge business." Following this statement, a graph showing food company revenue dwarfing that of animal protection organizations appeared on screen. I'm not sure if Meredith got the joke. Since 2013, the industry quietly continued to push ag gag laws through state legislatures, despite public opinion. In August 2013, a policy representative from the National Pork Producers Council said, "We did a study of coverage of ag gag laws that found 99% of the stories about it were negative." Stepping outside the echo chamber. Animal activism is no longer on the fringes. Farmed animal activists at animal conferences often begin slideshow presentations with pictures of younger versions of themselves. True to stereotypes, many movement leaders got their start in the punk scene, with dreadlocks, pierced noses, or my favorite, the 10-inch yellow mohawk of David Komen Heide, who is now executive director of the Humane League, a leading farmed animal protection nonprofit. While there's nothing wrong with that style, many of those activists have discovered that business casual allows them to reach new audiences. They can even enter the corporate boardroom, where so many important decisions for animals are made. These activists have stepped off the streets, tucked the public outrage sparked by undercover investigations into manila folders, and slammed them onto the desks of CEOs with demands for concrete policy change. The victories they've achieved help animals in truly staggering numbers. For example, in 2015, the year these reforms started picking up steam, Mercy for Animals ran successful campaigns for higher welfare policies at top food companies that impact an estimated 7 million farmed animals annually. Most of the animals affected are egg-laying hens, who will now live in cage-free sheds instead of constricting battery cages. Other policies banned cruelties like tail docking, the standard industry practice of cutting off dairy calves' tails with no anesthetic. That 7 million figure comes from calculations by Animal Charity Evaluators, ACE, the research organization where I previously served as chair of the board of directors and then as a full-time researcher. We took the number of affected animals used by these companies, such as dairy cows if it was a tail docking policy, accounted for our best estimate of the proportion of impact MFA was responsible for, since other organizations and pressures also contribute to the success of these campaigns, and reduced the estimated impact for those corporations publicizing welfare aspirations rather than actual policy. Using a similar methodology in 2016, ACE's estimate of MFA's corporate impact skyrocketed to 150 million animals due to both rapid progress in cage-free egg policies and the introduction of reforms for chickens raised for meat. The latter reforms included less cruel slaughter methods, the addition of windows and perches to the closed sheds the birds spend most of their lives in, and the use of higher welfare chicken breeds that have fewer health issues. MFA's 2016 corporate campaigns budget, including all overhead costs, was just over $1.1 million, so these campaigns appear tremendously cost-effective. Leah Garces is the executive director of the U.S. branch of Compassion in World Farming, CIWF, a UK-based farmed animal protection organization leading many of these corporate campaigns. Garces told me she got her start helping animals as a teenager in the 1990s, going vegetarian because some of her friends were, including her boyfriend, who is now her husband. In college, as her concern for animals grew, she defaulted to the veterinary medicine career path, but a thoughtful professor at the University of Florida suggested to her that veterinarians were like plumbers, fixing individual issues as they come up, but not improving the system itself. Garces has been able to build invaluable coalitions to help farmed animals at the national and global scale. The movement stretches across a range of ideologies and intensities. Many advocates who strongly oppose animal farming are more comfortable being as far away as possible from company executives and factory farmers, the people they see as causing intense suffering to billions of animals. But because corporations have so much control over the lives of these animals, advocates who successfully negotiate with them directly can affect big changes. Garces, a unifier nonpareil, told me about her visit with Craig Watts, a fed-up factory poultry farmer working with Purdue, one of the nation's largest chicken companies. She hoped Watts would join CIWF's campaign against factory farming, but as she was driving out to his farm with a film crew, Garces worried about the possibility of an ambush by farmers because Watts sent her some joking texts about his industry friends. She decided to persist, however, and her courage paid off. The factory farmer's denouncement of Purdue's practices achieved major news coverage. Now, there has been some debate about how much welfare reforms, particularly cage-free egg policies, actually benefit the animals. Unfortunately, in some ways, cage-free sheds are even worse than battery cages. For example, the ground of cage-free sheds is typically covered in feces, which the birds root through and stir up as they walk around, resulting in poor air quality and respiratory illnesses. And the large number of hens, typically thousands, sometimes over 10,000, crowded together in one shed, makes it difficult for them to establish a pecking order. Because hens can't sort out their place in the social hierarchy, they end up constantly fighting. Hens also injure each other with forceful pecking, and some die from what is effectively cannibalism. This harmful behavior is thought to be driven by the lack of appropriate pecking substrates like litter or dirt for young chickens in a barren environment, meaning the birds direct their natural pecking drive at the only available option, other chickens. It spreads more easily in a cage-free environment due to the large number of individuals interacting with and learning from each other. This abnormal behavior does not develop in small flocks of free-range or backyard birds with plenty of space and an interesting, complex outdoor environment. Ultimately, researchers mostly agree that the direct benefits of cage-free reforms, mainly the ability of hens to express some semblance of natural behaviors like perching, dust bathing, and just walking around, outweigh the downsides. But the downsides remind us not to set our sights too narrowly on short-term reduction of suffering. Another skeptical question we can ask about the impact of these reforms: are activists really the ones causing these policy changes, or are they just taking responsibility for actions the food companies would take anyway? Well, you don't have to take the word of activists. Take it from Chad Gregory, president of the United Egg Producers, an industry cooperative representing around 95% of U.S. egg production. Here's a section of a March 2016 article in Feedstuffs, the largest U.S. animal agriculture news publication. As for what's causing the rapid rate of announcements, Gregory said HSUS and the Humane League have been harassing and bombarding every retailer, every food manufacturer, every food company there is with a very aggressive cage-free campaign. They're the ones that have been driving this. There is no question about it, he added. Further evidence of advocate responsibility comes from the timing of announcements. Companies rarely make policy changes except shortly after a round of advocate pressure. In private conversations with researchers, industry executives have confirmed the impact of advocate pressure. The skeptical reader might still worry that welfare reforms don't reduce the size of the animal agriculture industry. They might even increase the industry's long-term success by alleviating the concerns of consumers who are complacent in the belief that they can buy the products derived from those animals guilt-free. I was worried about such complacency in the early days of my research, and I still actively look for ways to prevent it. However, animal advocates have debated the longer-term effects of welfare reforms for years, and I've come out convinced that the positive indirect effects outweigh the negative indirect effects. In particular, I think pushing for these policies generates more momentum against animal farming than complacency with the current system. Let's dive into this a little more and outline the three main reasons to expect momentum over complacency. First, current evidence suggests that most successful social movements have also taken this sort of incremental approach, even with their bigger goals in mind. British advocates fighting slavery, for instance, initially focused on abolishing not the whole establishment of slavery, but the trade that supplied it, with the intention of starving the broader institution to ultimately take it down. They also worked to ameliorate the condition of existing slaves. In fact, the slave industry's refusal to make more than very minor concessions, and the difficulty of even making and enforcing changes as paltry as requirements for subsistence standards for food, clothing, and shelter, seems to have spurred the public outrage that fueled the final push for abolition. We could see a similar process of attempted reforms, failure to reform, than a push for abolition with modern industries like animal farming. Second, there is some evidence, both theoretical and empirical, that welfare reforms might reduce total production through their effect on price. Namely, it tends to be more expensive to treat animals better. If higher welfare practices were profitable, the industry would likely already be implementing them. Empirical data points supporting this theory include the rises in egg and bacon prices following the European Union's passage of anti-confinement legislation, which banned battery cages and most uses of gestation crates, metal enclosures for pregnant pigs so small the animals can't turn around, and a similar rise in egg prices and subsequent drop in production by 35% due to the passage of Proposition 2 in California. There's an interesting tension here between making these reforms acceptable to the mainstream and having the maximum ethical benefits. Many advocates try to downplay these possible price increases to make the reforms seem more palatable to meat-eating consumers, but I'm happy to endorse the increases. We pay more for more ethical standards in other industries, and animal farming should be no exception. Price increases will also, all else being equal, reduce overall consumption of animal-based foods and increase consumption of healthy, ethical, affordable plant-based foods. I don't hesitate to say that this is a positive side effect. Finally, consider how these reforms inspire the activists and donors who see real, significant changes happening because of their contributions. These incremental incentives are easy to forget about. But if farmed animal advocates only fought for major policy change to decrease or eliminate the production of animal products, the lack of tangible successes in the meantime would likely discourage many of them. Welfare victories establish precedent for more than just the movement and industry. They signal to media, intellectuals, and the public that farmed animals matter and that farmed animal advocates are a powerful force, worthy of press coverage and serious consideration. Just as individuals work to be consistent in their behavior, so does society. Taking one action to help farmed animals strengthens our identity as a society that cares for farmed animals, increasing the likelihood of further welfare reforms and the adoption of animal-free foods. This is backed up by some limited experimental evidence from 3 small-scale experiments in which participants who were given information about welfare reforms took greater interest in reducing their animal product consumption than participants who were given unrelated information. Victories also build relationships. A farmed animal advocate who pens an op-ed on the benefits of cage-free housing can later pitch an article on animal-free food to the same editor, using that established trust from having worked together in the past. A nonprofit that works with a food company on welfare reforms can later work with them on animal-free food adoption. There is also evidence of a correlation between countries with higher welfare standards and higher rates of vegetarianism. This evidence should be qualified by the likely influence of outside variables, such as a more embedded general concern for animals, which probably leads to both higher welfare standards and higher vegetarianism rates. Besides cross-country data, similar correlations have been found within the U.S. and the Netherlands, where people who favor higher welfare animal products are more inclined toward vegetarianism. Vegans, vegetarians, and reducitarians. When investigators and other advocates share videos and otherwise engage with the public, they need to include an ask or request, some action an inspired viewer can take if they want to help end the animal cruelty, environmental damage, or other harm they've seen. This activism can be very compelling. A recent advance has been the use of virtual reality headsets to immerse the audience in the life of a farmed animal. This tactic has been pioneered by Animal Equality. One video takes the audience through a chicken slaughterhouse via a camera hanging between two chickens as a worker sharpens his knives in front of them, ready to slice the throat of each passerby. For the past three decades, the movement's ask for viewers eager to take action has almost exclusively been for individual diet change, either for the viewer to reduce their meat consumption or leave animals off their plate entirely. How successful has this been? The data here is limited. The few surveys that have been done over the years, mostly in the U.S., have varied in their methodology. A 1978 poll found that 1.2% of those surveyed self-identified as vegetarian, and a 1992 poll found 7% self-identification. After 1992, the best polls we have are those conducted by the Vegetarian Resource Group, which asked respondents whether they never eat certain products and counted as vegetarian those who checked off each category of animal flesh, red meat, poultry, and seafood. The results were 0.7% in 1994, 1% in 1997, 2.5% in 2000, 2.8% in 2003, 2.3% in 2006, 3.4% in 2009, 5% in 2011, 4% in 2012, and 3.4% in 2015. Around one-third to one-half of self-reported vegetarians in each poll indicated they consumed no animal products. We also have the Gallup poll, conducted in 1999, 2001, and 2012, that asked whether people self-identified as vegetarian. It found that 6%, 6%, and 5% did, respectively. This poll data is only weak evidence because of the statistical margin of error in these polls. But overall, this suggests that there was a significant increase in the number of self-reported vegetarians sometime in the late 1990s or 2000s. Anecdotally, veteran activists basically agree with this trend, and it syncs up with the release of investigations and new plant-based products over the past few decades. We have little data for other countries, but polls mostly suggest figures between 2% and 12%, with the clear outlier of India at 29%, largely due to religious vegetarianism. Survey results indicate around 54% of Americans are self-identified reducitarians, meaning they are currently trying to consume fewer animal-based foods, meat, dairy, and/or eggs, and more plant-based foods, fruits, grains, beans, and/or vegetables. We also have some data for the total number of animals slaughtered in the U.S., which suggests an increase until 2008 and a stabilization thereafter, which is promising given the continued growth of the human population. The base of this pyramid of concern for farmed animals is even wider. A 2014 U.S. survey found that 93% of respondents felt it was very important to buy their food from humane sources. 87% believe farmed animals have roughly the same ability to feel pain and discomfort as humans, and an astounding 47% of U.S. adults say in a survey that they support the seemingly radical policy change of a ban on slaughterhouses. As we conclude our discussion of the current state of the movement and move on to future directions, I want to note my concern with this heavy focus of the movement on individual diet change, which has made outrage at animal farming virtually synonymous with vegetarianism and veganism. In my view, this has alienated many potential supporters, and overall has been one of the two biggest mistakes of the movement, along with the gimmicks and attention hunger of PETA and similar groups discussed earlier. Fortunately, we will see throughout this book that the movement is shifting toward a focus on institutional change, targeting companies, social groups, and society at large with impressive results. 3. The Rise of Vegan Tech. Josh Balk and Josh Tetrick, the Joshes, defy vegan stereotypes. In college, Balk played baseball and Tetrick played football. They're imposing, with big smiles and charming wits. When you ask them how their work is going, they compliment everyone but themselves, their team, their customers, and especially you. In other words, you'll want to buy anything they try to sell you. Handsome Creek. The Joshes founded Hampton Creek, now known as Just, in 2011. I first visited their San Francisco office in 2015, where my colleagues and I were welcomed by a tongue-lolling golden retriever named Jake, who might have been officially employed as the office greeter. We sat down on the couch near the front of their office as we waited for our tour. It was the prototypical Bay Area tech startup workplace, with Apple computers, an open floor plan, and seemingly not one person over the age of 40. Tetrick was sitting on a bar stool chatting with some well-dressed investors, whom I later learned represented Li Ka-shing, a Hampton Creek investor and one of the richest people in Asia. Because we were nonprofit workers, our tour was guided by Balk. Balk has actually never been employed by Hampton Creek, instead opting for nonprofit work, primarily with HSUS, where he's currently vice president of farm animal protection, having replaced Paul Shapiro. Before working with HSUS, Balk worked as an undercover investigator. He told us about his investigation of a chicken slaughterhouse around 2004, where he took a job in order to secretly videotape conditions at the facility. On the slaughter line, workers grabbed chickens by their legs to pull them out of transport crates and held them at eye level to shackle them upside down from a metal cable that pulled the birds through the slaughter process. First, it dragged them through an electrically charged water bath to immobilize them. Then it slid them across a spinning metal blade to slit their throats while they were still conscious. And finally, it dropped them into a pool of scalding hot water for defeathering. At the last stage, many birds were still alive because the first two steps did not reliably kill them. Balk's smile slipped away when he told us this. The repetitive labor of working the slaughterhouse line is often physically and mentally stressful and degrading for slaughterhouse workers. Balk had these problems and more, as someone who appreciated the moral personhood of each individual animal he was sending to the 150-degree Fahrenheit water. Balk stayed motivated and sane by knowing he was capturing footage of this cruelty that would potentially help millions of animals avoid this fate once it was released to the public. In those early days of the farmed animal protection movement, the investigations were nowhere near as sophisticated as they are today. Balk wore a large, cumbersome recording device under his shirt. On the slaughter line, workers would tap each other on the abdomen to indicate it was time to switch line positions. But since investigations weren't as well known back then, Balk managed to evade suspicion despite the strange object. Perhaps his co-workers thought it was a medical device. On his last day at the facility, he became bolder. He openly displayed a camera to get some higher-quality photos of the birds in the facility. The head of security caught Balk taking pictures, but let him go after Balk showed his worker ID, warning him that he didn't want to see the photos on 60 Minutes. Balk even talked the security guard into taking a photo of him next to the birds. As we will see, this audacity has also driven bold and very successful business strategy at Hampton Creek. When he told us about his transition from investigator to policy at HSUS, his smile emerged again. Now he puts on a business suit and meets with animal agriculture executives to persuade them to adopt higher welfare policies. Balk is nothing if not a dedicated pragmatist. In his 15 years of advocacy work, he has never taken a sick day and has only missed work for one vacation, a few funerals, and to volunteer on election day for various candidates, including his dad, 5 times. Despite this relentless work ethic, or perhaps because of it, Balk's smile rarely fades. One of Balk's key realizations at HSUS was that the executives at big companies, despite their reputations as selfish Scrooges unconcerned with ethics, are typically just as uncomfortable with animal cruelty as the rest of us. According to Balk, they see current business practices as a necessary evil, but an evil nonetheless. Of course, these savvy business leaders were surely to some extent just trying to placate HSUS, but the evidence they showed of genuine concern nagged at Balk constantly in the days before Hampton Creek. He told me that he remembered one meeting in particular with General Mills, where the executives clearly wanted their company to adopt a